Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. Today's show is brought to you by Cosmic Origins. It's a conference that's happening on the 26th through the 28th of this month, and it's going to be held in Sedona, Arizona. And they are pretty much the sponsors for today's program. And you got to check out this lineup. They have Robert Bavall and Dr. Robert Schock talking about the Sphinx. They are our special guest today, and boy, it's quite interesting. But it's not only them. It's William Henry. There's a trip to local petroglyphs that is very cool. 3,000-plus petroglyphs in that area of Arizona. And it'll be led by native Clifford Mahudi. And there's just a lot of stuff to check out. For more information, go to worldviewzmedia.com and then check out their seminars. It's a very, very cool program. And most of the program today, most of the show today is going to be filled with very cool aspects of people talking about this content. So check it out. Okay, here's today's show. Saturday, May 20th, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, well, the article that I wrote for Ancient Origins magazine is coming out next week. The title is Advanced Engineering Discovered at the Observatory at Chichen Itza. And it's a surprising discovery. I was working with Jim O'Conn. He's a forensic engineer, and together we have discovered what we believe are facades, special walls built into these deep pits that are on the side of the observatory. And you can read all about it. It'll come out next week. I believe it's coming out on the 23rd, Tuesday the 23rd. And all you got to do is just go to ancientorigins.net and you can see it. I'm also going to paste it on the Facebook page, and I'll have it on the website too, earthancients.com. So check that out, Advanced Engineering Discovered at the Observatory at Chichen Itza. The observatory is also known by El Caracol, which is the snail. And they call it that because the interior of the observatory is two spiral staircases. Now, I have a theory about most of the Yucatan. In fact, I have a theory about most of Mexico, and that is that at one time it was covered underwater. And it's my feeling, and I'm writing about this, that most of the Yucatan Peninsula was hit by a deluge. And I don't know if it was the biblical deluge, 9,500, the Younger Dryas or not, but when you see the photographs of the excavation of these ruins, of these buildings, and in this case, the observatory, El Caracol, they're covered in sand, they're covered in sediment, and you got to remember, the Maya used cement, and a lot of this cement's been tested, and it's some of it's stronger than, or equally as strong as what we use today. So a building like that doesn't come down easily, doesn't come down through wind, doesn't come down through just age. It takes a real force to knock a building down. And every single building, except for perhaps the ball court at Chichen Itza, is disassembled. It's ripped apart. And I believe the damage was done by tsunamis, and then it was covered under water for, I don't know, a long period of time. And when we see the photographs of these specific buildings, and I see most of this in a number of photographs from the early excavations in the 1920s, you see basically piles of stone And they have to reassemble. They have to consolidate the stones and reassemble them. Now, that doesn't happen through gravity. It doesn't happen naturally. It happens through a violent event. So, okay, anyhow, I'm on my soapbox on that. But check it out, the article, and I'm going to be writing more about some of the other buildings that we check out later too. By the way, today and tomorrow, I'm going to be attending the Contact in the Desert at Joshua Tree, and I'm speaking to a whole bunch of people that will be on upcoming shows. Really excited to be speaking with Eric Van Doneghan. He's got a new book on the Maya. And a number of other people. Andrew Collins is going to be there. Graham's going to be there, Graham Hancock. And Robert Bavall, Robert Schock, Michael Tellinger, who we had on last week, and a bunch of other people. So I will be sprinkling future shows with some of these short interviews, and then we'll have a few long ones too. So stay tuned for that. Hey, speaking of the Maya, don't forget the tour, the Maya Mexico tour. It's coming up October 28th through November 4th. This is your chance. This is your chance to hang with me, and we're going to climb these pyramids. And we're not going to climb one or two. We're going to go pretty much to every place we can and climb the buildings and see the buildings and get up close and personal with the details of a lot of these ruins, the ones that have been well excavated. And we'll have shaman in a few places to do ceremonies. And I really, really encourage you to join me, because not only is the price half off, because remember earlier last year I had, the tour that I was going to do with this other company was like $2,800. I think when you threw your flight in there, it was like $3,500. That's like outrageous. Hey, this is $1,600, half off. And it covers everything except for your lunch. We take a air-conditioned bus. We're going to be down there during Day of the Dead so we can wear face paint and jump around. And it's going to be so cool. I hope you can join me. It's, again, 28th through October 28th through November 4th. Go to earthancients.com and check it out. I think you really will enjoy yourself. And it's a chance to be introduced to really an ancient culture that is right under our feet, right just south of us. So come on down with me.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Always a lot of good stuff to check out. You got to go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, and go to the group page. And we have a lot of contributors every week. We have people from around the world that put in galleries from their home country. We have a lot of authors that are continually profiled. And it's really, Earth Ancients is really, if I don't blow my own horn, I will blow my own horn. It's one of the top, if not the top, Facebook page for ancient Earth articles on known and unknown civilizations. So to start it off, we have an article that was written in 1909 called The American Egypt, a record of travel in the Yucatan by a gentleman named Channing Arnold. And he co-wrote it with a guy named Frederick Frost. And this is an article that really describes what these early English travelers encountered in Yucatan just as people were discovering them again. And there's a ton of really, really cool photos of very, very old parts of Chichen Itza and some of the other ruins. And you can see when they first discovered, like the photo that I have here of the observatory, it's totally pushed down. It's a pile of rocks. And there's other photographs of the pyramid, the El Castillo pyramid, the ball court, and some of the smaller ruins of Chichen Itza. So it's always cool to read how people interpret these ruins when they first came upon them, because they're pretty cool. And these photographs are, they really make it fun. They make it a lot of fun just because you see the condition in the, of these buildings, and there's no way they were being used. They were probably in this dilapidated state for thousands of years. So pretty cool to check out. Also, we got a new gallery from our friends at Satellite Archaeology of Canada, and they have submitted a new gallery with about 30 photographs of ancient Australia. And it's just kind of cool because, I mean, these satellites are many miles above our atmosphere, and they're showing geoglyphs, but they're also showing land masses of carvings, and they're glyphs. And they have kangaroo, wallabies. They have creatures that have probably been extinct. So these are, you know, fairly old geoglyphs that we're looking at. You can see it on the Facebook page. And like I said, 30 photographs. Pretty cool. One of the big news announcement of the week is in Canada, a number of miners were chiseling through a wall of rock, and they have uncovered the best dinosaur fossil ever found. And you got to see this thing. It's a 110 million year old nodosaur, which is a plant eating dinosaur that is monstrous. It has these huge spikes. It looks like a CGI, a special effects. It's so good. The eye is complete. Apparently, this dinosaur fell in the water and was preserved by the salt water, and it sunk in the mud. And so its scales are in a very great detail. The fossilization of the entire body is so perfect. They have close-ups. National Geographic has submitted this. It's so perfect that you can see great details in the scales, in the head, in the tail. And they present in this article a three-dimensional look at this dinosaur, nodosaur, and details, close-ups of the head, the body, and it's amazing. It's one of the best fossilized dinosaurs ever. In fact, they're saying it's the best preserved ever. There's no decay. I can't believe it. So that's something to check out. The other thing is, I have placed a overhead drone video of Ekbalam. Well, we're going to be going to Ekbalam on this Maya tour. This video is fairly recent, and it shows the details of this ancient Mayan city, and it shows the very peculiar buildings that we'll see when we go there. There's a round building that is probably the most unusual mini pyramid I've ever seen. It's round in the back and round in the front, and you enter a small staircase. We also see the main Acropolis with this monstrous main pyramid. We see the entranceway. We see all the areas we're going to be walking. So check that out. It's one of the nicest videos I've seen, and you can see it on Facebook. So Cosmic Origins is our sponsor this week, and we wanted to have one of their main presenters talk with us. So we have Robert Bavall with us to talk a little bit about what he's going to present. But not only him, but there's some other great news about the Sphinx that he is going to present to us. So here's Robert Bavall. Cosmic Origins is our sponsor for this month, and we have a number of great people we've been talking about, Robert Bavall, Robert Schock, and a number of other people that are there that are quite influential in a number of areas. But I wanted to talk to Robert Bovall specifically about why he felt this was a unique program and some more information. So we have Robert Bovall on the show. Robert, how are you?
Hi, Cliff. I'm fine.
Great.
Your question is very pertinent because this is going to be a very unique conference. And the reason is this. Many of you listeners know about the rather famous predictions made by the American seer Edgar Cayce in the 1940s, where in trances he gave readings claiming that there was a chamber put under the Sphinx by survivors of Atlantis in 10,500 BC. Now, I was not into this sort of thing for a long, long time, but I've written a book called Cosmic Womb with an astrobiologist, looking at all the latest cutting-edge sciences, like quantum mechanics and various other sciences, neurosciences, and I'm beginning to believe that Cayce did manage to somehow link up with some form of knowledge through his trances. However, at these conferences are two of the protagonists that were physically there in an attempt to locate the possibility of this famous Hall of Records. In 1993, Dr. Robert Schock was there with a team involving part funding of the Cayce Foundation, where they did seismographic tests in the Sphinx area. And lo and behold, they detected a chamber some 5 meters below the poles of the Sphinx, a rather large chamber, which is precisely where Edgar Cayce said it would be. Another expedition was mounted in 1996, again by founders of the Cayce Foundation. In that expedition was Dr. James Hertak, who's going to be in the symposium next week, in a couple of weeks. And he too was directly involved with the search. This time they used ground-penetrating radar, and they detected, not only confirmed the chamber that was detected by seismographs in 93, but they also detected a large chamber under the rump of the Sphinx. Now, as you also know, the date of 10,500 BC is very, very crucial to this kind of prediction. I'm the person who worked out in 1996 the alignments of the Giza Necropolis and confirmed that the map, if you like, of the pyramid and the Sphinx correlate to a sky image of the sky in 10,500 BC, whereas where the Sphinx marks a equinoctial marker of the constellation of Leo. But the point that it's actually marking is the vernal point, or what we call the spring equinox, which at that time in 10,500 BC is under the Sphinx. So now we have astronomy linking up with geology, seismographs, radars, amazingly pointing that Edgar Cayce was correct. So what we're going to do at this symposium is put all these heads together, bring all the material we have, photographs, videos, and the discussion will be open, and I think it's not to be missed.
Wow. So will there be some documents as to the seismographic study that was made and images and things like that to see?
Indeed. And there is a video. I cannot comment too much on it now because we want to keep it as a surprise. That was done during these expeditions, which will be shown for the first time to the audience. They will actually see with their own eyes what went on during these searches. And we reserve this for the audience that will turn up.
Fantastic. So I have with me the information. If you want to get tickets to this event, it's Worldview Z, the letter Z, Media. .com, and you can get tickets for this weekend. We don't know, I don't have the schedule yet, but I imagine it's Saturday or Sunday, the 27th or 28th, one of those days this talk will be given. So, Robert, that's great news. That's an exciting part of that show, and I thank you for that insight.
I'd like just to add something very, very quickly.
Oh, sure.
There's going to be at this conference an English researcher, mathematician called Gary Osborne. Gary Osborne and myself have been working very closely in the last couple of years. And again, with the astrobiologist Dr. Chandra Vikramasinghe. And this is the first time we're going to seriously talk about the possibility that there has been perhaps an ET contact involved in this project, building the pyramid. So there you are. Don't miss this symposium.
Okay, that's pretty big news, for, especially from you, Robert, talking about aliens. That's not typically something that you're highlighting in your work.
Absolutely. I wouldn't touch the subject with a barge pole 10 years ago, but I have to say that the evidence is mounting in that favor, and I'm very, very much moving in this direction because the evidence is overwhelming. But again, all this will be revealed at the symposium.
Wow. Okay, again, the web address is worldview, the letter Z, media.com, and that's where you can get more information on this program. Robert, thank you. I know you're calling from Spain, and we appreciate the insight.
A pleasure. Thank you.
So that was Robert Bevall giving quite a interesting presentation, a preview of what can be expected at this upcoming Cosmic Origins in Sedona, Arizona. It's going to be the 26th, 27th, 28th. It's a week from this coming Saturday. That's Memorial Day weekend. And for him to actually admit that there could be an ET presence is pretty shocking. He's been a devout anti-ancient alien, as I have. I really have to see more evidence in light of what I see, what I have experienced. But hey, I'm an amateur. And I bring to you what I think are some of the best people to discuss this. And the ancient alien hypothesis now is spinning out of control. We now know that Carl Sagan in 1961 wrote a paper on his belief of ancient aliens influencing the Sumerians. NASA tried to suppress it until this year it was published. And so you have to start thinking more seriously about it. But of course we need more proof. So if you want to check out Sedona, if you can get out there to that Cosmic Origins conference, you can learn more about it at the worldviewzmedia.com website and go to seminars. I was given a book about 2 weeks ago, and it's a book that I couldn't put down. It's called Origins of the Sphinx, Celestial Guardian of the Pre-Pharaonic Civilization. It's by Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock of Boston University, and Robert Bevall, who we just heard from. And this book presents all the latest evidence on the Sphinx, more details on its positioning, its projected age based on the geological dating. But there's a lot of information on various passages, maybe what it was once looked and appeared, why the Egyptologists basically have it wrong. And you're going to hear from both of them right now. The Roberts, I call them the Roberts, Robert Schock and Robert Bevall, discussing this new book, this collaborative book. So I hope you enjoy this interview. So recently I got a copy of a new book from Inner Traditions, a publishing house that I work with quite a bit. And the title of this book is quite unique. It's Origins of the Sphinx, Celestial Guardians of the Pre
pharaonic civilization. It's by Robert Schock and Robert Bavall, two real seminal individuals who have not only spent a great deal of time in Egypt and studied these ancient ruins, but have written extensively about that part of the world and really opened our eyes to some of these new discoveries. And I have them on the program right now. Robert Schock, welcome.
Well, thank you. So it's great to be. I can't talk. It's great to be here.
And Robert Bavall, from calling from Spain, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I want to start out really to talk about real quickly in both of your in your minds. What was the thought behind a collaborative book? Because both of you are strongly opinionated about your work, but I found that you both mesh quite nicely in the work. I'm going to go ahead and address you by your last name so we can move through this. But Robert Bavall, what was the idea of working with Schock based on his work?
Well, I've known Robert Schock since 1995, I think, Robert.
And, yeah, somewhere around there.
Long time ago.
It's been a long time.
And, well, it was inevitable that sooner or later, in this case later, that we'd work together on a book, mainly because Robert, of course, working with the geology, and I working with the archaeoastronomy, arrive at the same conclusion, i.e. that the Sphinx is a much, much older edifice, structure, mm-hmm. and you know, inevitably, we linked together in 95, I think, when we did a documentary in Egypt, and then we kind of stayed more or less in contact, except that we wrote books with I wrote books with Graham Hancock, mm-hmm. a few of my own, and but it all gelled when we met again and spent time together in Bulgaria, isn't that right, Robert?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And Schock, what about you? What was
I think the basic point is that Robert Bavall and I are looking at the same object, namely the Great Sphinx, looking at the Giza Plateau, but we are really coming at it from different perspectives. Robert Bavall is really coming from an archaeoastronomy perspective, and everyone knows about the Orion correlation theory, mm-hmm. and how that ties back to this earlier date, we'll say 10,500 BC. And I'm looking at it from a geological point of view, looking at the actual rocks, the actual stones on the ground, and coming to the exact same conclusion. So we complement each other very well. Our data meshes together very well. And one way to summarize it, as a couple of people have said to me, is it's the stars in the sky and the stones on the ground, and both pointing to exactly the same message.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I should emphasize, and hence the reason why this book was essential, because archaeoastronomy does not and cannot prove that the Sphinx is an older structure. It can show the link with the alignments and the using precession, mm-hmm. but it needs the geological work of Robert to confirm the actual age in the physical sense. Mm-hmm. So I think this why this book becomes a much more solid approach to trying to date these things, i.e. that archaeoastronomy points to a date, whereas geology confirms the date in a physical sense.
Right. Robert, let's start with you. You have a section. Robert Bavall. Here we go. I'm going to say Robert Bavall. So here we go. The first area that I want to cover, and you talk a little bit about this, is that standard alliance of academics on the carving of the Sphinx is that it's fourth dynasty, and it's the image of Khepphren. And this has been going on now for decades. And a number of people have said otherwise, but what do you say about this? You actually say that there's a lot of new evidence regarding this time limit?
Well, regarding the actual head and face of the Sphinx, you know, I'm always puzzled that at Egyptologists linking it to Khafre. I mean, it doesn't take a forensic expert to see the face and see a statue of Khafre and realize that we're not dealing with the same person. Mm-hmm. The face, unfortunately, has been damaged quite a bit through the various millennia. And under repairs in recent times, but it's still has features that to me indicates a negroid feature. It looks more negroid to me than it looks like Khafre, or at least on the statue that we see. The other thing to bear in mind is that the statues of Khafre are not necessarily his exact appearance. Most pharaohs were depicted in a very stylish manner, mm-hmm. and we can't rely on statues to tell us how they look like. But there is no question in my mind that we're dealing with two different faces. Having said this, there is evidence that textual evidence that the recarving or a reshaping of the face took place in the fourth dynasty and by King Khufu. Now, if that's the case, it certainly adds credence that this face has been touched upon. He would be repairing a face of his son, which was supposed to be following him. So much suggests that what we see there is the face. What individual we can't tell, but it's not the face of Khafre.
Okay.
If I could make a quick comment.
Of course.
Sure. Yeah, and Robert Bouval just mentioned this, but I really want to emphasize it for the listeners. From my perspective as a geologist, I am absolutely convinced, based on the evidence, that this is not the original head. This is not the original face. The entire thing has been recarved in dynastic times. So at a certain level, I don't really care whose face it is because it's not the original face. I mean, it was probably a lion, in my opinion, mm-hmm. And we talk about this in the book. It's been recarved, so whether it's Khafre or not really is a red herring. It really makes a difference.
That's a good lead-in to my next question to you, Shaq. In Chapter 2, which is a mind-blower for me, you present decades, hundreds of years of photos of various phases of the Sphinx through periods of reconstruction. And it looks like, from your assessment, that the Sphinx has been constantly repaired for perhaps thousands of years. My question to you, and I think that you did bring this up previously in some TV perhaps, is that the original Sphinx was carved from a solid single piece of a rock. Is that what your assessment is?
Yes, the Sphinx is absolutely 100% bedrock, the original Sphinx. Something that's very misleading to people who go there, and both of us take groups to Egypt periodically. I was just there in February, March. And you take people there that have never been there before. They look at the Sphinx, and sometimes you get the comments, well, it's made out of a bunch of little blocks of limestone. And you see that on the paws, for instance. You see that on parts of the body. But those are all repairs, some of which are modern, some of which are ancient. The original body of the Sphinx and the original head on that body are all one solid piece of limestone. Now, this is bedrock limestone. Living rock, as geologists will sometimes refer to it, it's not a block that was moved. I mean, the Sphinx is so huge, you could not move a block that large with any capability that I know of, any possibility that I know of. It is bedrock. And when they carved the Sphinx originally, and we talk about this in the book, originally, the head was probably an outlier, a knoll, a yardang, more or less a chunk of rock natural bedrock that was sitting up above the surrounding plateau. So it probably attracted attention, may have been carved into some kind of a head, maybe a lion's head originally. And then later, or simultaneous with that, we don't know, but we are talking in very, very ancient times. Let's just think 10,000, 10,500 BC. They carved down into the bedrock around what was to become the body of the Sphinx. So when you go to Egypt, for those who have not been there, you actually look down into the Sphinx enclosure or the Sphinx pit to see the body. The body is below the general level of the plateau. So it's all solid bedrock. And yes, it has been, in my assessment, repaired, restored numerous times over thousands of years. According to Zahi Hawass, he continues to maintain that the oldest repairs go back to Old Kingdom times, to Fourth Dynasty times, over 4,000 years ago.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Has anyone been able to get up into the Zahi Hawass, but do we know what remains of the actual original head? Because if they attach this head that we see now.
It's not attached.
Head is not attached. It's the new head that's been attached. And in answer to your question, years ago, I was allowed to walk along the back of the Sphinx and climb. There happened to be ladders at the time because they were doing repairs, and I was allowed to go up onto the Sphinx. So I have been on the Sphinx. I have looked at the head, you know, firsthand, up close.
Okay.
And it is all one solid piece of bedrock. What you have is a situation where the original head became highly eroded, and this will get into what was causing that erosion, precipitation, rainfall, pre-Sahara rainfall. There's no doubt about that geologically, and this is part of the whole issue of when does it date to. You don't have precipitation, rainfall that could cause this type of weathering and erosion in the last 5,000 years. But the head became heavily weathered, heavily eroded, heavily modified, but it was a larger head. This is my assessment. And then in dynastic times, instead of trying to repair the head in the sense of putting in little blocks of stone to repair and restore whatever original features may have been left, my opinion is that they recarved this older head and it became smaller. And in fact, the head is too small for the body right now, if you look at it proportionally.
Yes.
In fact, the head is. And one of the first things I want to say, one of the first things I noticed when I went to see the Sphinx for the first time, and this is still clear in my memory. So this was decades ago, my first trip to Egypt, and I saw the Sphinx. It sort of looks nice from the front, but you walk around to the side and you see immediately, at least I saw immediately, that the head is disproportionately small for the body because it's not the original head. It's the stub of the original head recarved and made smaller.
That's fascinating. Has somebody looked and figured out how they engineered these massive stones that make up the face? Because, I mean, obviously they couldn't have glued them. They've made...
No.
I think... Can I barge in, Robert?
Go ahead.
I think you're... The whole structure, the whole Sphinx is from the living rock, as Robert said.
Right.
There's added repairs around the poles, a bit on the ramp, some of them dating from Old Kingdom times, probably in New Kingdom times, and recent times. I've actually seen people working and repairing the Sphinx in the last 15 years or so. But it's essentially was one structure cut from the living rock. It's actually tied to the bedrock on the ground, if you like. And so the idea that the head is detached, or that's quite incorrect. I think one thing that Robert will agree with me is that there's a lot of emphasis on the Sphinx itself, and all that Robert said, I fully concord. But people tend to forget that the Sphinx is attached to two temples. or there are two temples in the vicinity of the Sphinx, one in front of it, called the Sphinx Temple, and one slightly adjacent towards the south, called the Mortuary Temple. And these, I'm sure Robert will agree, give indications also of a much, much earlier date than prescribed by the Egyptologists. Do you want to take over, Robert, or
actually,
shall I?
I should mention, I was mentioning my first trip to Egypt. One of the first things I studied were those two temples. Mm-hmm. And I actually came to the conclusion that they were older than the traditional Egyptologists state before I was absolutely convinced about the Sphinx. So
interesting.
Those are incredibly important. Let me describe a couple of aspects of them that are pertinent, and I'll try not to go into too much detail. But geologically, we can demonstrate, and this has been demonstrated not just by myself, but other geologists independently, those temples are composed of limestone cores. So limestone cores made up huge megalithic blocks weighing tens of tons. Actually, a couple of them are probably well over 50 tons, maybe approaching 100 tons. Those blocks did not just come randomly from anywhere. They were actually quarried out of the Sphinx enclosure mm-hmm. When the body of the Sphinx was being carved. So those core limestone blocks making up those two temples are contemporaneous with the carving of the body of the Sphinx. Do you understand what I'm saying? So those temples are as old as the oldest portion of the Sphinx. They were later heavily eroded and weathered, again by water. I can determine that. I've been able to determine that geologically. Water in terms of precipitation, rainfall coming down from above. Sometimes people say, oh, it must have been Nile floods. No, you can demonstrate geologically it was not Nile floods because Nile floods would give a different type of weathering and erosion pattern. Mm-hmm. These were heavily weathered and eroded. Then later, they were repaired by the Egyptians using Aswan granite, huge blocks of Aswan granite, which are much later than the original temples. And those Aswan blocks of granite have inscriptions. There's still a couple of inscriptions remaining, very highly eroded, on the so-called Bali Temple that indicates they were there. They were either in place or they were already there in Old Kingdom times. Okay. So if you're repairing something in Old Kingdom times, you know that the original structure is much, much older.
Yeah, the weathering on those temples is similar to the Sphinx or not?
It's not just similar, it's identical.
It's identical. Okay, well,
identical. It's developed a bit differently. So it's the average person might look at it and say, well, how can you say those are identical? No, it's identical from a geological point of view in terms of the nature of the weathering, the type of weathering. Again, this is something that we could discuss for 3 or 4 hours on each in the field. And I do that with people sometimes when I take there and they're very interested. But yes, and as I said, that was what convinced me initially. Even before the actual data of the Sphinx.
Okay.
Can I add a bit more on these temples?
Of course. Go ahead.
Notwithstanding the geological analysis that Chocks just gave, which is quite correct, there is the architectural analysis or investigation. I mean, what's odd about these temples, as Robert pointed out, is that they're built with blocks ranging from about 50 tons. There's a few of them going up to 100 tons. There is even one or two, I think, going up to 200 tons. A 50-ton block is an enormous piece of stone. It's if you can imagine, roughly speaking, something like, I would say about 40 or 50 large size four-wheel drive cars squished into one lump. That's the weight and size of these blocks. But from an architectural point of view, there's something very odd about the choice of building these temples with these large, massive megalithic blocks. Principally because it's totally illogical to build anything with these size of blocks. And more pertinently, we know of a complex not far away, which is the Step Pyramid Complex, which was built just before, by the dynasty, the Third Dynasty, before the so-called Old Kingdom, Fourth Dynasty. Now, the Pyramid Complex, the Step Pyramid Complex, there are many structures, particularly the entrance wall. There's a boundary wall that's still standing in the east southeast part. There is a few temples within, so-called dummy buildings. But the point I want to bring out here is that they're built with blocks that roughly are about, I would say, about 30 to 40 kilos. The sort of blocks that today we would use, we wouldn't exceed this weight, mainly because we'd expect a mason to be able to lift them and put them into place. So that's a logical way to build. Now, they obviously knew this, and they knew this in the Third Dynasty. So looking back now at the temples in front of the Sphinx Temple and the Mortuary Temple, it doesn't make sense. They knew how to build with regular small size blocks with perfection, whereas using this kind of massive blocks, apart from an engineering difficulty of moving them around and lifting them, I just can't imagine how this was done. It's totally, totally illogical, totally unnecessary. And furthermore, if you look at the pyramids on the plateau, none of these blocks are used of this size. The largest block, if I'm not mistaken, is at the bottom of the second pyramid, of Khafre's pyramid, which is about, I think, 25 tons. Is that correct, Robert?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so these temples, to me, is a great mystery. They obviously are of a different type of engineering construction. The erosion suggests them being very, very old, much older, but it suggests a completely different contractor, if you like, using a completely different technique, which in itself doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to use blocks of this size. It's just crazy. If today I would be asked to build a temple or of that size, I would use what they used in the Third Dynasty, blocks of about 20 to 30 kilos. So to me, everything points to a completely different phase that we're looking at, the Sphinx and its two temples, and probably the temples further up, closer to the pyramids on the east side. These form a complex in my mind, and I'll explain this when you ask me questions about the archaeoastronomy.
Well, that's exactly where we're going next. And I want to talk about the position of the Sphinx and your general feeling that it's facing the star cluster of of Leo, the lion, astrologically. Archaeoastronomy is a valid science, and it's shown to be valid, and it's accepted widely. Why does the Egyptological group basically say we do not think that's a valid idea, and dating it to 10,000 years, which is when the actual alignment is shown? I mean, that's the big problem for them, is that you're saying here is a date that is so far out and away from anything they can conceive of, they don't want to even give it credence. Is there anything that anyone can do to help them understand that this is a valid concept?
Well, I think one of the main problems with Egyptologists, at least the ones I know, is that they're very uncomfortable with astronomy. There is a very unfortunate attitude that the minute you mention astronomy, they link it to astrology, which is a science that is
is deplored by most scientists. But astronomy is nothing to do with astrology. However, in the sense of what we're looking at Giza, we have to put ourselves in the context of the people, prehistoric or whoever they were. There is no doubt whatsoever, and Egyptologists agree with this, that whoever designed the pyramids and designed this complex was using astronomy. The alignment of the pyramids is well known. I mean, this has been known for over 150 years, that that they're all aligned to the cardinal direction, the astronomical cardinal direction. Mm-hmm. We also know since the 1960s that there are shafts within the Great Pyramid that were aligned to star systems. And, of course, the Orion correlation theory, which adds to all this astronomical input, showing that there is a correlation between the layout of the pyramids on the ground with the Orion's belt. So having said this, there is nothing... There is nothing sort of woo-woo or strange about concluding that there is an astronomical quality about this necropolis. Mm-hmm. I always find it bizarre that the Orion correlation theory was so aggressively attacked. I mean, it follows a sort of ABC logic, using already existing research. The shafts of the King's Chamber were not discovered by me. They were discovered in 1964, their alignments, I mean. I found the alignments of the shafts in the Queen's Chamber. What it boils down to is that this, the design of these monuments, the design of the pyramids and the Sphinx, for example, is, I think at first glance, anybody who knows anything about even the most basic astronomy, we realize that the Sphinx is looking due east. It is what we call an equinoctial marker, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the minute you speak of a figure, such as a lion, it comes to mind the constellation of Leo. Now, how do you link it with that constellation? Well, here comes the science of precession. And again, with Egyptologists, precession is something that they shy away from. I don't think so much these days, but certainly when I started, I mean, I always had to explain over and over again what it is, and they kept saying, well, ancient people could not know about it and that sort of thing. Precession is something very, very simple. There is a wobble of the planet that causes the position of stars to shift in a cycle of 26,000 years, and it's observable. It's easily observable within one generation. So if you align, for example, two stones in a direction pointing at a certain star rising, and you come 50 or 60 years later, you will notice that the alignment, the star has shifted from this alignment. So it's something that's easily detectable, especially with people who observe the sky all the time. And that we know from the ancient Egyptians. Hmm. So, having said this, I think slowly, the idea that precession, astronomy, and analyzing this site and other sites, by the way, and analyzing the texts, the pyramid texts, with what I call observational astronomy, naked eye astronomy, and to try and link the statements that are made in the text and try and understand the alignments of the monument, is something that is slowly creeping into mainstream Egyptology. So that's at least one achievement.
That's something to think about, I guess. I've been to a number of museums, Egypt museums, and seen great evidence for their interest in, it looks like, astrology and astronomy, kind of a combined effort. They obviously had a science of some kind that we don't know, where they combine these things, and it seems like it's a very everyday kind of an occurrence. Robert Schock, what do you have to say about a possibility of a combined look into the stars, into the cosmos?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is that we, and when I say we, I come from an academic background. I well, I'm an academic. I continue to teach at Boston University full time. Most of my colleagues, as Robert Bouval just said, make a very sharp distinction between astronomy and astrology. That distinction is very, very recent in time. You have even Galileo, one of the great heroes of modern, you know, physics and astronomy. He cast horoscopes. There's still remaining to this day in one of the archives, I forget where now, his own horoscope in his own handwriting. Kepler, he figured out elliptical orbits of the planets. Why? Primarily to cast better, more accurate horoscopes. So my point is that right up until modern times, there was not the distinction that we now make between things like astronomy, astrology, between science and religion. These were all combined in a different concept. So I have no doubt that when you're looking at the ancient Egyptians or their predecessors going back much further, they were not making the distinctions that we now make between astronomy and astrology or religion and science in general. And, you know, why do you build some of these structures? Why do you align them to the skies and the stars? Some of it might be very pragmatic from our Western modern point of view, but some of it may be very impractical, but that doesn't mean it wasn't important to them.
Yeah, and it, so many of these megalithic sites that we discover around the world are built on an astronomical grid. So this is becoming quite mainstream, and so it kind of is interesting to note that a lot in the academic, especially Egyptology, seem to have a problem with these alignments. Robert Schock, I want to move forward into something I'm curious about, and you write about it, in your new book, and that is the use of water in and around the Sphinx. Now, I've talked to a number of engineers, people like Chris Dunn, that have said and speculate, because they haven't been underneath the Sphinx, that it may have been some kind of a mechanic hydraulic that pumped water up into a causeway into the Great Pyramid. And to support that, and we'll never know for sure because Hawass isn't the supreme director of the area anymore, but I've seen pictures of Hawass poking his head up through what looks like a drain on the side of the Sphinx. And recently I saw a photograph of him climbing up from the front of the paws of the Sphinx into what looks like some kind of canal. Do we know? And it's been speculated through some ground penetrating radar that there are underground causeways that carry water and things like this. This is known, not generally known, but it's known through certain areas. Can you discuss the waterways of the Sphinx, if there are some kind of underground?
I don't want to say this. To put it bluntly, I don't think that the Sphinx was a pump. I don't think that the Great Pyramid was some kind of grand pump. These are theories that have been circulating for decades now. Yes, you have all kinds of tunnels and passageways throughout the Giza Plateau, including a tunnel that are probably a collapsed tunnel along the body of the Sphinx that Thomas DeBecchi, a geophysicist, and I found when we did our seismic work in the 1990s. And I would still like to get back there to continue this research. There's a chamber under the left paw. There's another chamber under the left rump, which is, I think, what you're referring to when Hawass was sticking his head out. That may well be just Greco-Roman, relatively late period. So there's a lot going on. There's frankly a lot of misinformation going on at the Giza Plateau too. And one thing you have to realize, I'm a geologist. The Giza Plateau is a limestone plateau. It has been subjected over not just the millennia, but over millions of years, longer than any humans have been on the planet, to all kinds of geological processes, including what we call karst processes, more or less limestone cave formation, that type of thing. So you have a lot of natural tunnels and limestone features, as well as the artificial ones. And in many cases, at least what I see as a geologist, when you look at some of these caves and tunnel type features on the plateau, they started out as natural features which have since been modified by human intervention, you know, in many cases, thousands of years ago. But this is typical of what we find around the world, where you have tunnels and cave systems. A lot of times they begin as natural features.
Okay.
I fully concord with Robert here. I mean, there's many misinformation going on, and this idea that somehow the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and other structures are somehow related to pumps and hydraulic systems is totally incorrect. There is nothing of the sort. I'd like to say something, though, because we left the astronomy a bit too fast. There is no doubt in my mind, and I think many Egyptologists do agree on this, is that the ancient Egyptians believed in what we today would refer to as a sky religion, as seen from our perspective. They believed that Egypt was some sort of reflection of the sky or a counterpart of the sky. This is very obvious from their texts. And one thing about the sky is that literally it's a billboard. It tells time, and it has images, if you like, constellations, the position of planets, the position of the sun at certain times of the year. So you can write a story, and that's something that being 30 years on this matter, I'm very, very convinced that the Egyptians very cleverly used the sky as a kind of register, if you like, of their chronology. Hence why we see structures that are aligned to specific stars, in the case of certain temples in Upper Egypt, the star shafts in the Great Pyramid, and the Sphinx. So every time you look at these monuments, you realize that they're marking time. They're marking time and they're telling a story, and the story can be read literally in the sky. So that's something that I am very, very sure will become eventually something that most Egyptologists will realize, is that you have to read their texts, you have to read their monuments in conjunction with the sky. So that's what we do in this book in large part. It isn't just the Orion correlation theory and saying that the Sphinx and the pyramids lock to a certain date of 10,500 BC, the pyramids lock to Orion's belt at a meridian passage at that date, and at exactly the same time, the Sphinx is gazing at an image in the sky, which is clearly the constellation of Leo, its counterpart. But there are other texts. There are many other texts, particularly texts at Edfu. Can I mention this a bit, Robert?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, which were not dealt with by anybody, by the way, in conjunction with the Giza Necropolis. And this is the first time, I think, in this book that it's done. Because the Edfu texts, as they're known, are carved on the walls of a temple in Upper Egypt, known as the Temple of Horus. But it's from various textual material, and even Egyptologists are okay on this one. It's a temple built on a much, much older structure. And probably, almost certainly, the texts that are carved on the wall are repeating a very, very ancient tradition. And this tradition is that there was a beginning. They have a name for it. We find this also in the pyramid text. They call it Zeptepi. Zeptepi literally means the first time. I think I'm the first one to have discussed this in a great detail in my first book, The Orion Mystery, although it was mentioned here and there by Egyptologists. But this, to me, is the key to understand what they had in mind. They clearly believed in an historical period that, if we go with the astronomy, began around 10,500 BC. They are very adamant about this. And from the Edfu text, they tell us that there is a moment where their first king or divine king by the name of Horus, all pharaohs believe themselves to be descendants, reincarnation of this Horus king, won a great battle at this period of the first time, And they give us a date, quite amazingly. They actually give us a calendrical date in their own civic calendar, which is the 1st of Tibi. And this is the first day of the 5th month of their calendar. Now, I don't want to go into too much details here, but this is very, very interesting because we can relate their civic calendar to our Gregorian calendar of today, and that comes to the 19th of October of our existing Gregorian calendar. Now, here is the punchline. There is a causeway that runs from the second pyramid, the temple on the east side of the second pyramid, all the way down to the valley temple at an angle, bypassing the Sphinx on the south, at an angle of 14 degrees. And amazingly, this causeway, which includes, if you extend the causeway further to the east, is the valley temple, points to the rising of the sun on this particular date. So now we can make a link between what is said in the Edfu texts and what is seen on the ground. They're literally telling us that there is a place where this Horus, original king, was commemorated, and I believe very much so that the Sphinx and the two temples, the Sphinx temple and the Valley temple next to it, mm-hmm. and the mortuary temple above the causeway next to the second pyramid, is part of a very, very old complex commemorating this initial first pharaoh of the first time. So this is very new in the book. And I think there is no doubt that we're looking at a very, very long tradition based on this idea that there existed a Horus king. Now, surprisingly, to add to this, even the name of the Sphinx bears a connection to this Horus king. The Sphinx was called Horus of the Horizon or Horus in the Horizon in New Kingdom text. And we show in the book, by the way, that this idea of a Horus in the Horizon is also in the Pyramid texts, where they refer to a celestial figure. So all this ties up, if you like. And this is what's slowly coming out, is that we're looking at we began to call, I don't know if you agree with me here, Robert, is a solar complex that pre-existed the construction of the pyramids and probably dating from the 11th or 12th millennium BC.
Wow. No, I absolutely agree. And I think a very important point here, which you've just made, but to summarize it for the listeners, is that we have not only archaeoastronomy, but and geology, which say the same thing, but we've got the texts and traditions, and they all point to exactly the same thing, and they all interrelate, they all lock together. The chances of this happening just by random, you know, if there wasn't something to, it's virtually impossible.
Yeah, you know, like they say, you know, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it looks like a duck, it must be a duck.
Exactly.
You know, there's too many things that interlock, pointing to this golden age, if you like, this date, this epoch of Zeptepi, mm-hmm. this first time. And astronomy at Giza gives a very, very, very precise the epoch of 10,500 BC. It's uncanny to have two sets of monuments on the same site, the pyramids on the one hand, matching what we see in the southern sky in 10,500 BC with the Orion's belt, and exactly, at exactly that same moment, not a minute before or after, you have the rising of Leo in the direction of the Sphinx due east. It's a million to one coincidence, if you like. So to me, this ties it up. But of course, like I did insist, and I do insist in the book, that we can read this with astronomy. We can read this in the text, but geology is the key. And that's why the weight of the geological argument makes it not just a story that they're telling us or buildings aligned. It actually brings the date in reality in physical terms.
It sounds to me, Robert Bavall, that you have a feeling that Horus may have been an actual person and was this was known by the Egyptians, and that we have maybe misinterpreted this in our modern society because it's so old that he was, you know, that we think he was a god. It's too old to have been a human being. It's too far back in history for any consideration. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. Well, I'm suggesting that the so-called mythologies that are attributed to these texts by Egyptologists is most probably an historical narration. You have to bear in mind, of course, that history was not written in terms of what we write history today. History was, yes, mythologized. It was linked to sky events, but it is nonetheless history. And I think the Egyptians are telling us their history. They very cleverly tell us their history by writing it, if you like, on a billboard that is in the sky. So once you understand this, once you understand that the sky is a kind of stained glass window, if you like, that can be read, and once you can interpret what happens in the sky with the text, then you begin to understand what they're telling us. Mm. And marrying all this with physical evidence, I mean, to me, the geological work of Robert Schork is the punchline, if you like. Because one could argue that, yes, they're commemorating a date, but it's still mythological. Yes, they're telling us of a beginning, but it's a sort of biblical equivalent of the ancient Egyptians giving us an Adam and Eve story. But geology brings it to the physical reality of that date. So I think too many things intermesh to tell us that we're looking at history and not some sort of story that is told in these texts.
Wow, that's a real thought, and something that I think more of us should consider. And this is this book does discuss some of that. Robert Schork, is there comparable? When we look at Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey, is there any comparable design in the stonework there, or anything that we can kind of link to the megalithic builders of this early period that we find in the Giza Plateau?
Superficially, Göbekli Tepe does not look like the Sphinx or the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, those two temples associated with the Sphinx. But I would point to a couple of things. One, Göbekli Tepe is made, they're considerably smaller, admittedly. They're only in the 10 to 15 ton range, but it is composed of megalithic stone blocks, stone pillars, which are absolutely beautifully carved, the same finesse, the same abilities in a different way, I would say, are expressed at Göbekli Tepe. Robert Bouval was mentioning how it makes no sense to build a structure out of blocks that are 50 to 100 or more tons. One could argue that in terms of Göbekli Tepe, from a pragmatic point of view, why would you make pillars that are 15 tons tall, incredibly thin in their narrowest dimension, which means they could easily break and snap when you're trying to erect them. Mm-hmm. So they're doing something else. And in both cases, they are astronomically aligned. I've done work in a book that complements, I say, Origins of the Sphinx, one of my books, Forgotten Civilization. I talk about Göbekli Tepe, and I continue to work on the site, mm-hmm. Study the site. We have astronomical alignments, including, I believe, to Orion. So you have a lot of similarities. And something else that's very, very important, in my opinion, is I'm a geologist, so I think in terms of the Ice Age and the end of the last Ice Age. The Ice Age ended 9700 BC. I use that date based on the Greenland ice cores. It ended, we'll just say in rough terms, 12,000 years ago. This period of Zeptepe, this golden age, is reflected, I believe, both on the Giza Plateau and at Göbekli Tepe. Göbekli Tepe, the oldest portions, without a doubt, in my mind, based on various analyses, date back to the same early period, before the end of the last ice age. And in both cases, what I think we have is the obvious question might be, well, what happened to this early culture, this early civilization, both at Göbekli Tepe and on the Giza Plateau? There were devastating circumstances at the end of the last ice age. The last ice age ended in incredible turmoil, I believe, from a solar outburst in 9700 BC. And it seems to have devastated this early, what I call the early cycle of civilization. So Göbekli Tepe is, in my assessment, very important and ties in with the bigger picture.
Interesting. Robert Bevall, I want to ask a follow-up question regarding the megalithic stonework at the Giza Plateau. I've seen the Osirian, and this is a very odd structure, simply because the stones are huge, many, many, many tons. There's no mortar that keeps them on top of each other. They're just heavily weighted on top of each other. Is there any ideas that are new regarding its connection with, say, the Sphinx or the Great Pyramid? Or is there any relation to any new findings of a megalithic block building?
Not really on this particular site, but when Robert was talking about Göbekli Tepe, it occurred to me that we always tend to forget in these discussions that there is another site in Egypt this time, to the south of Egypt, the extreme south of Egypt, known as Nabta Playa. I've written a book about this with Thomas Brophy, the astronomer, called Black Genesis. But this site, which has been known since the early 60s, has been dated with carbon 14 dating and various other strata using strata dating to about the same time that we call this Tepe-Zepi time. And we know that this site, and this has been investigated not just by myself and Thomas Brophy, but astronomers in the United States have written several articles about this, that we find the same astronomical alignments. We find alignments to Orion's belt. We find alignments to the star Sirius. We find alignments to the solstice, to the equinoxes. So there we have a site within Egypt that is using stone, that is using similar astronomical alignments, literally within something like 600-700 kilometers from the 900 kilometers from the Giza Plateau. So to me, I think to for Egyptologists to keep denying this, I mean, I rarely see Nabta Playa being mentioned, let alone Göbekli Tepe, as you probably know, Robert, with Zahi Hawass.
Right.
In the context of the Sphinx. I mean, these are sites within the region that give the same date. So we have to really start very seriously considering that there was some sort of prehistoric culture. To what extent it was, I do not know. What caused its demise? I leave this to the geologists like Robert Schock and others who have come up with theories. But to me, clearly, there was a very active megalithic society that eventually found its way around that time in the Giza Plateau. There is something else, by the way, that we bring out in this book. I'll be very brief because I think we're running out of time. Regarding the Edfu text, insist that all the information of the what they call the original temples, the very first ever temples built in Egypt, were kept in a sacred book called the Book of the Sacred Mounds. Now, we haven't found this book, but they keep insisting that this book existed and that the information of the location of these early temples, but they give us the region. They tell us that it's in the region of Memphis, and Memphis is what today is. I think we're looking at these so-called original temples. I believe that the original temples were actually natural features that included the knoll that Robert mentioned, the knoll that became the head of the Sphinx. So I think we have an area that somehow grabbed the attention of these very, very early
people living in these regions, and saw this site as some sort of sacred place. Probably started with the venerating an owl, looking a bit like the head of a lion, and eventually led progressively to constructing the Sphinx, and in much later times completing the whole project by adding the pyramids.
You know, it's funny, and it's wonderful that we have this multidisciplinary approach to studying the ancient past and Egypt. And I find it's quite revealing from an engineering point of view, from a geological point of view, to actually view these buildings and what we know of their writing and the expertise of each of these fields brings new light to understanding our ancient past. I don't understand what the big problem is with Egyptology to consider geology, to consider engineering, consider archaeoastronomy in getting to the bottom about what was happening in the ancient past. So I don't know if this is a death knell for Egyptology or not, because we won't name names, but the bearers of Egyptology appear not to want to know to stretch further into the past and to discover if there was an ancient society that were the megalithic builders of this place. So one final question, and then I think we're at the end of our time here. We'll start with you, Robert Schock. What do you what would you like the reader to get from this new book, Origins of the Sphinx? What is your hope?
Well, I hope that this book really convinces people, if there was any doubt before, that there was an earlier cycle of civilization. I'll use that term, that there really was a Zeptepi, there really was a flowering of genuine civilization before the close of the last ice age, before the devastation that we see geologically 9700 BC, that there was a cycle of civilization. This is reflected first and foremost from my based on my work, because this is where I started really studying ancient civilizations, with the Sphinx. And the Sphinx is the physical remains. It's part of the physical remains, along with the associated temples, that go back to this early, if you want to call it, primordial period, this early, as we say in the subtitle, pre-pharaonic civilization. And that this civilization was absolutely set back, devastated, however you want to say it, by natural catastrophes, natural events at the end of the last ice age. And to me, it's not just sort of, you know, interesting to study these things and, oh, gee whiz, isn't that exciting that there was civilization at an earlier period? Yes, that's all true. But I also think we need to learn from their wisdom, learn from what they have to teach us, and also realize that they didn't last forever. And, you know, things change. And just like them, we're not invulnerable. We I think sometimes in our modern technology have too much hubris, and we should be a little bit, you know, realize nature can do us in.
Exactly. Robert Bevall, same question to you. What you've contributed to a really nice new book. It's, boy, does it have a lot of material in it. Some papers that you've both written, a lot of illustrations and photos and things like that. What is your hope that the reader extracts from this writing?
Well, my hope is for the Egyptologist. I don't know if you're aware, but I've written a book that will be published at the end of this year with an astrobiologist, a rather famous one, Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe. And it's a rather unusual book, but because of this book, I've had to learn all sorts of new sciences that I was totally detached from, particularly quantum mechanics. And I'll make a kind of analogy here. I mean, we live in a world now with what is known. We have the classical way of looking at the world, and then I'm referring to, of course, the theory of general relativity, Isaac Newton's and Einstein's theories that work very well in the classical world, but then we have the quantum physical world that is very, very different. The problem with Egyptology is the same. We have an old classical lot that refuses to budge. They've written their books, they've set their consensus, and they simply won't look at new ideas, especially ideas that radically change the chronology and what ancient Egypt was all about. So I'm hoping that this book kind of stirs up a bit of the new generation, a bit and move into what I call the quantum mechanics of Egyptology. In other words, to look at sciences that are needed to comprehend what was going on and the messages, because what Robert said is very, very correct. There is a message there. This project isn't just because they wanted to build something nice. And this is a huge enterprise, an enterprise that boggles the mind even today. You know, giant pyramids that we still haven't figured out how they were built. We still haven't figured out how they moved certain stones. We still haven't figured out a lot of things. And to me, there's a message that is important to understand what happened at the time. So I think what my real hope is that young Egyptologists start having a bit of courage and pick up these new ideas and start doing a new direction in Egyptology.
I think one way to summarize this might be that it's simply time to rewrite the history books when it comes to the origins of civilization. I mean, seriously, so much is put into history books, textbooks, and then people think, oh, that's the definitive truth. They read it in Egyptology 101 or whatnot. And I don't mean to sound nasty here, but I've spoken to a lot of Egyptologists over the decades, and many times it seems, whatever they were taught initially, they can't get away from that. So we really do need to rewrite the history books and stay young. And I think it's sort of a truism in many sciences and many disciplines that you don't really change one generation's thinking, but you have to wait till the younger generation comes in. And that's something that Robert Bouval was just mentioning also. So you wait for the old generation to literally die off, retire at least, and the younger, fresh generation who has an open mind can come in and start looking at new evidence, new data.
Yeah,
correct. I'm beginning to join this old generation, though, Robert.
Both of us, we stay young at heart, and we stay young mentally.
It's either they die off or they're removed from office, right?
There you go.
Well, yeah, there's one particular person that
should have. We won't name names, but we know what we're talking about.
Well, I don't mind naming names. I mean, Mr. Zahi Awad should have gone a long, long time ago. Something is holding him there. I'm not quite sure what, but yeah, he's been a huge obstacle to a lot of research that is needed there. So yeah, we have to wait till the path is cleared.
We could go on and on here. This is a wonderful book. It's the Origins of the Sphinx. I've had Dr. Robert Shock with us today, and Robert Bouval. I do want to mention that they're both going to be at the Contact in the Desert conference, which starts Friday the 19th of this month and goes until, I believe, it's Monday the 22nd. I was looking at the schedule. Robert Shock, you're speaking almost every day there, and Robert Bouval, I think you at least have two or three talks. You'll be there too. So if you want to see them both in person and hear their talks, you can go to contactinthedesert.com. I will be there to say hello to each of them. And if you're there, please stop by and say hi. I'll have a little booth there with some recording. We'll be doing some live recording during that program. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. This is quite a unique book. And let me see here. Oh, it was published it came out on Amazon a couple weeks ago. So it's available to get.
It's fresh out of the printers, yes. Can I just add something quickly about these conferences, Cliff?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, for those who can't make it to Contact in the Desert, there is a conference immediately afterwards in Arizona, in Sedona to be precise, called the Origins Conference. And Robert and I are going to be there with a host of other well-known.
I'm glad you mentioned that because they're our sponsor this month, so I should make sure that we do mention that.
I thought I should remind you. Yes.
Thank you for that heads up. So you're both presenting talks there. Are you both going to be doing the walk out to the petroglyphs too? And
yes, we are. Okay. We'll both be at the petroglyphs. We'll both be speaking. So if people could what do I want to say? Two opportunities: contact in the desert and or Sedona.
Very good. Thank you for that heads up. And yes, I will have more information on that in the coming days. I will post that on the Facebook page. Go to Earth Ancients, go to the Facebook page, go to groups, and I will have that information up there. Gentlemen, thank you again, and it's been good to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. The book is going to be out. Oh, excuse me. It just came out. Just recently came out. I have a case of books. If you want to get a copy, I'm going to raffle these books off in the next week or so. Send me an email. Say, Cliff, I'm interested in the Sphinx book, Sphinx, Sphinx. And send me an email to cliff@earthancients.com. I'll raffle it off at the end of this month. That's approximately 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks from now. And like I said, I have 12 copies. I'll send one out to you if you're the lucky winner. So check that out. Okay, that's it for today's show. Make sure that you tune in next week. I'm going to be interviewing a number of top people. Next week's interview is with Eric Von Doniggen. And he is presenting his new book on the Maya, his belief that the Maya were greatly influenced by ETs. I'm going to talk to him about that. I'm going to get right down and ask him where that evidence comes from. I got to tell you, though, I've already got a preview of the book, and he has some amazing photographs. One photograph I'll let you in on is a photograph of gears. Beautifully carved gears in a standing stone. And I mentioned those before, but this is one of those suppressed photographs you just don't see anymore because they pulled it out of the public's view, and it's, I don't know, it's in some garage somewhere in Honduras where Copan is, an ancient Mayan city. So next week, Saturday the 27th. All right, be well.